William Burroughs, at least throughout the history of the last 11 years here at Naropa, where William Burroughs has been adjunct faculty, she's one of the few women, I think, that has sort of been entrusted into the inner chamber of what William Burroughs really thinks. I'm just going to turn it over to Ian.
Thank you. Good evening. Can you all hear? Okay. Well, tonight we're going to examine the cut-up method of William Burroughs in both his writing and in his experiments with tape recordings. Jack Kerouac once called Burroughs a master linguist, a master of human speech, the master of the science of language. And through his work with cut-ups, this mastery was expanded, because as you interrupt and rearrange words and what people in fact say, or voices heard in dreams or in fantasy, routines, and the like, you actually deepen your understanding of the way language works. Gertrude Stein wanted to change the function of parts of speech. She, for example, attacked nouns. She decided she wanted to really sort of do away, use a lot of nouns, and yet do away with their function in pieces of writing. And then at other times, she would write in nothing but participial verb forms. And in fact, she came to understand how words could work in a different way and work on many levels, including the psychological level. It seems that Burroughs's actual sources, what he chooses to work with, are much richer and more complex, more extended, in that they reoccur in innumerable and endless various permutating combinations. A lot of writers have worked with collage, as you know. Several who come to mind are William Carlos Williams, for example, in his great epic poem, Patterson, in which he actually worked with found texts, letters, snippets of history, his own lyric poetry within this larger composition, which became the epic of a place, and that place also became somewhat of a kind of muse energy or heightened spirit, you could say, sort of a picture of a particular place and all the kinds of things that went along with that. T.S. Eliot in The Wasteland. The Wasteland is really a collage of sorts, actually edited, put together by Ezra Pound. Charles Olson's great Maximus poems, the cantos. I mean, we could look at a lot of modern poetry from this point of view in terms of arrangement and method. And going back in time, the Dante Alighieri's famous Vita Nuova is a collage of sorts combining various stylistic modes as well as other kinds of sources. He has, what he actually did was write poems at a particular time. He went back and then wrote a kind of exegesis in prose off those poems, telling what his method was. You get some of the same kind of thing in the work of some of the writers I've mentioned, but also in Burroughs, you know, different places where the narrative breaks into a more poetic line, for example, or works with found texts or dreams. In Dante's Vita Nuova, he actually incorporates dreams into the text and describes what the dream was and then writes a poem which echoes the dream. So you find that same kind of thing going on here. Maybe some of you know John Ashbery's early book called The Tennis Court Oath, which was working with cut-up method. And he actually drew on, in one source I know in particular, was a Victorian children's book called Many Hands, where he actually lifted, you know, some phrases from that. And there are other kinds of things that go on in there, overheard conversation. He was traveling, I think, in the writing of one poem called Europe, where he literally sketched as he went along. And certainly Kerouac has done that kind of thing. So you could use the word collage to cover a wide range, and some of that gets into the more, you know, explicit cut-up direction. But it seems that no one, there's also Ted Berrigan's master collection called The Sonnets. It's actually about 80 to 100 pages, which are literal cut-up sonnets, 14-line poems, which employ sort of steals from Rilke, Rimbaud, King Lear, etc., and also his own writing, the time of day, what he's eating, snippets from a conversation. And there's an interesting permutation that takes place with the sequence. So you find some of the same lines coming back. And he was very influenced by Burroughs's method, I know, in that particular work. But no one, it seems that no one's really gone as far yet as Burroughs in so sort of, you wouldn't say mercilessly, but relentlessly deconstructing his own and others' writing and speech, I might add, through this method. And he's also given much thought and attention to the implications of cut-up, you know, from some grander view, from a sort of visionary viewpoint, or philosophical, or political, and so on. So the implications of cut-up and the value and political necessity of such a method to free us from mind control and totalitarian structures. And I'll play a cut-up that he's done from just moving the dial on the radio around. I mean, it's, you know, something maybe some of us have played with already. And of course, the front page of any newspaper is, in fact, a cut-up, a surrealist poem, you could say, you know, all these disparate things going on. Literally, you could scramble all that material even further. And it's the kind of thing we, I've played with TV, for example. We've all done that. And you sort of turn the sound off. You lessen the control or the fix that really can have on you. Somehow, the images combined with the words have more power. When you separate them, you're breaking down some of that control. So there's an interest there in examining the input that's coming at us all the time and works on a lot of levels, subliminally, etc. The cut-up, and by extension, the fold-in method, which Burroughs uses, uses that particularly in Nova Express, where he literally would take other texts and fold them in, fold a page of his own and a page of the other, and combine them that way, or put the found text in the middle and have his words around. There are innumerable ways you can cut up. You can cut the page of writing like a pie, you can cut it this way, you can cut it line by line. You can take the top and put it in the bottom backwards. I'm sure you can imagine all the permutations. Anyway, these methods have been used most extensively in the novels which came after Naked Lunch. And, well, actually, there's, of course, First Junkie, then Queer, which is going to be published this fall for the first time. That book will be in print. But Junkie and Queer and Naked Lunch, although Naked Lunch is somewhat episodic and certainly collage-like, the actual methodical use of cut-ups came after those texts. So it begins really with Soft Machine. Well, there's an earlier collection of smaller pieces called Minutes to Go, which is in collaboration with Brian Geisen. And I think even Gregory Corso is in there somewhere, and Rimbaud and Shakespeare and a few others. But anyway, that's actually the first, if you want to be precise, published, very rare collection at this point, Minutes to Go. Soft Machine, 1961, Nova Express, 1964, The Ticket That Exploded, 1968, and Exterminator, 1973. The Third Mind, which maybe some of you have looked at, was published in 1978, and this is an actual anthology on a lot of the theory and examples of the kinds of experiments. So I highly recommend it if you want to pursue some of this further. So, and also a book called The Job explicates some of these ideas. That's more theory. All these books draw on quite a bit of the same subject matter. In fact, Soft Machine, Nova Express are based on outtakes from Naked Lunch. A lot of the same material. So you get some of the same character names, place names, phrases, and so on. How many have read those books? How many have read Soft Machine? Oh, good. And Nova? Great. Exterminator? Fine. Well, we'll be looking at some things in more explicitly from those three books. Anyway, all these books draw on a lot of the same material. And as well, you know, as well as exploring the theories, we'll look at some of the, you know, statements Burroughs has made about this method from some other texts, like the Paris Review interview and so on. This is from a lecture in the Talking Poetics book from Europa Institute. And he's talking specifically here about taped voices, because he describes an experiment that a man behind the Iron Curtain, Konstantin Radove, did with turning tape recorders on in empty rooms and actually picking up voices and phrases. And so Burroughs works with these phrases, and I have a tape of an experiment he did using phrases from his own lecture as well as phrases from Radove's experiments. So it's not actually a piece of writing out of one of the books. It's not finished in that sense and meant to be published as such in a, you know, novel form or poem form or whatever. But it's kind of spur of the moment experiment. I think what he did was actually have the text and went through picking out lines for the recorded experiment. But this is an answer. Well, he says, someone asked at the last session what the tape voices have to do with poetics. Answer, everything. Writers work with words and voices, just as painters work with colors. An important point here is the misconception that a writer creates in a vacuum using only his very own words. Was he blind, deaf, and illiterate from birth? A writer does not own words any more than a painter owns colors. So let's dispense with this originality fetish. Is a painter committing plagiarism if he paints a mountain that other painters have painted? Even if he paints a mountain from another painter's painting of a mountain? Writers work with words and voices. And where do these words and voices come from? From many sources. Conversations heard and overheard, movies and radio broadcasts, newspapers, magazines, yes, and other writers. A phrase comes into his mind from an old Western story in a pulp magazine he read years ago, can't remember where or when. And the quote is, he looked at her, trying to read her mind, but her eyes were old, unbluffed, unreadable. There's one that I lifted. All writers are plagiarists, steal anything in sight. Or a phrase comes to him and he doesn't even remember that he read it somewhere or heard it somewhere. The county clerk sequence in Naked Lunch derived from contact with the county clerk in Cold Spring, Texas. It was, in fact, an elaboration of his monologue, which seemed merely boring at the time, since I didn't know yet that I was a writer. In any case, there wouldn't have been any county clerk if I had been sitting on my ass waiting for my very own words. So the idea of like being on the job, more or less all the time, for whatever is coming up, coming your way. And remember once William was going to take a retreat, the sort of Buddhist center, and you know, there was some idea, well, you shouldn't take any writing utensils along, just see what happens when you don't have your usual, you know, habitual patterns or your, you know, the kinds of things you are attached to. The idea was to see how, where your mind would go. He absolutely refused. I think he finally didn't take a typewriter, but he, you know, insisted on a pen and paper, and he said, I have to get the work, you know? This idea of how it was, you know, it wasn't even an ego trip to be creating, but the work sort of came to him, and if he didn't honor it and record it and accept it, you know, it would somehow work against him. However, interesting sidelight on all this, which comes up recently, is quite amazing, actually. I was just introduced to this text, which is the introduction to Queer, his second novel, which is coming out this fall, as I mentioned. And it's quite a revelation, because he's very open in speaking of his wife's death, which maybe some of you know about, the accident where he accidentally shot and killed his own wife. And he's never really talked about this before in this way, in terms of what it meant in terms of his own writing. And in this introduction he says, "I am forced to the appalling conclusion that I would never have become a writer but for Joan's death, and to a realization of the extent to which this event has motivated and formulated my writing. I live with a constant threat of possession and a constant need to escape from possession, from control. So the death of Joan brought me in contact with the invader, the ugly spirit, and maneuvered me into a lifelong struggle in which I have had no choice except to write my way out," which is quite extraordinary. And, you know, thinking about that in terms of how he really became obsessed with the cut-up method, you could say, you know, really took it to extraordinary extremes and degrees, and then the theory behind it often, that he was, you know, trying to free himself from control, in a way, by taking apart things. It's almost like, you know, by naming the enemy or by photographing the enemy, you know, you have some power over the enemy. So, you know, it sort of sheds this interesting illumination on some of his practices. And also in this introduction, he includes, he hasn't worked with the cut-up method really since Exterminator. And Exterminator was a lot of out material from Wild Boys. And but the novels of the last few years, The Cities of the Red Night, Place of Dead Roads, The Western Lands, they're still episodic and collage-like and so on, but they aren't strictly working with the cut-up form the way he had done so extensively in the past. And so it was odd to see, as part of this introduction, written just recently, 1985, a short cut-up which deals with this whole issue of control, the ugly spirit, Joan's death. There's a mention of Denton Welch. Has anybody heard of Denton Welch? Wonderful English writer who was born in 1915, grew up in Shanghai, and at the age of 20 suffered a terrible accident. He was riding a bike and he was hit, I guess, I'm not sure how, crash on his bicycle, and his spine was irreparably damaged, and he was an invalid most of his life. He died in 1948. But he wrote several novels, Maiden Voyage, which is a story of actually growing up in China, In Youth is Pleasure, and A Voice Through a Cloud. And these are very important books to Burroughs, I know. And there's a description of the presentiment, this sort of feeling that he had before the accident. I mean, something was not quite right, you know, about the that day. And there was a feeling of actually being, you know, invaded by something, or something was going to go wrong. We've probably, all of us, felt that in, you know, other ways, maybe less tragic ways. So I think for William there was an identification on that level, because he himself has now described this feeling of doom and of almost being stalked by fate and this thing that was to be the day that he shot his wife. So in this cut-up, he's addressing that somewhat, and it was interesting to see that he was working with this method to kind of get through this experience and explicate it in the introduction to a very important book of his, which he hasn't wanted to have in print for a number of reasons. I think primarily that the first person in there, which is, you know, some version of Burroughs, is very vulnerable, and it presents a side of him that's maybe more naked, less disguised, less layered. You don't have 10 different, you know, characters sort of inhabiting this one first person, as you do in some of the other books. Anyway, I'll read it. This is written in February 1985. "I have constrained myself to escape death. Denton Welch is almost my face. Smell of old coins. Whatever happened to this knife called Allerton? Back to the appalling Margaris Incorporated. The realization is basic formulated doing. The day of Joan's doom and loss. Found tears streaming found tears streaming down from Allerton, peeling off the same person as a Western shootist. What are you rewriting? A lifelong preoccupation with control and virus. Having gained access, the virus uses the host's energy, blood, flesh, and bones to make copies of itself. Model of dogmatic insistence, never, never, from without, was screaming in my ear, you don't belong here. A straitjacket notation, carefully paralyzed with heavy reluctance. To escape their pre-written lines years after the events recorded, a writer's block avoided Jones' death. Denton Welch is Kim Carson's voice through a cloud, underlined, broken table tapping. It's an interesting way to actually address one's experience, you know, the cut-up. I recommend it, probably when maybe you don't understand what's going on and you do some writing out of a particular, you know, even emotional, psychological state, or using somebody else's words. And then, you know, by putting it through this process, we'll talk about that one more. So cut-ups provided Burroughs with a technique to further his break with narrative, linear, Aristotelian realities, and writing and logic and so on, as well as play with time and image and permutations of phrase. He was able to work further with the notion of illusion, impermanence, etc. He was able to take all the bit players. Sometimes you feel when you're reading his books, there are a lot of these, you know, it's nothing but bit players. You know, these people come and go. They appear in one, you know, 20 pages into the text and you never hear from them again. Or they shift names or whatever. There's this kind of, you know, the sailor, the sheriff, the county clerk, et cetera. Kiki, another young boy, the corn god. So he's able to take all these bit players and scatter and mingle them in different combinations, have them come and go more ephemerally. Also, cut-up breaks the, you know, breaks further this repetition of myth. And in last night's lecture, Eric Mottram was addressing that desire in Burroughs and that overriding reality of his work, which is, you know, working with deconstruction of myths. So he's able to break that down further. He's able to cut up, you know, sentimental myths of God, country, you know, country, government, flag, woman, the queen. He's also able to indulge these very outrageous and somewhat freaky fantasies in a way that's so extreme, and then contrast that with, you know, these very lyrical passages, which are primarily these cut-up passages of almost nostalgic phrases. So you get, you know, a very different mode going on there. That contrast gets very interesting. He's able to challenge, you know, sexual politics. It's a further way to parody fictions. Also, you know, I was saying these almost sexually sadistic passages are countered with the you know, these lyrical passages, which are memories often of, you know, times, various places. St. Louis comes back all the time. That's, of course, where he was born and grew up. a forgotten phrase. These things are repeated much more musically, so you have almost like a contrapuntal thing going. And I personally feel, and I'm sure maybe some of you would agree, that it's in these cut-up passages when you could say the poetry of Burroughs, a lot of people speak of him as a poet because he's visionary and prophetic in ways, and there's a great almost command he has. And, you know, when he says something's come out, they sound very true and powerful, et cetera, intense. You know, the language is often very condensed, and so works in a way that poetry works. And it seems that particularly in these cut-up passages, I feel that's where the sort of poetry really breathes and lives. And also the quality of evocation, you could say. And traditionally, tribally prose or narrative would report the events, activities, the story, kind of keep the thing rolling along. And then the narrative would break into poetry or song or reflection or kind of resonance or echoing of what had gone before. When the narrator needed to communicate a different kind of mood or atmosphere or emotion, traditionally it was when, you know, the narrative had to break down into something more emotional, poetic, more indulgent. So you'd stop, your time sense would change, and you'd sort of, instead of just kind of going along with the action or whatever, you'd stop and get lost in the so-called poetry chant or song, where the heart is so, you know, full in a way, it's got to sing. So Burroughs began working with the cut-up method in 1959-1960. He says, I was in Paris in the summer of 1960. This was after the publication there of Naked Lunch. Friend Brian Geisen, American poet and painter who had lived in Europe for 30 years, had introduced him to this method. I became interested in the possibilities of this technique, and I began experimenting myself. He mentions The Wasteland and Tristan Tzara. Tristan Tzara was a Dadaist Romanian who originally lived in Paris, and he had written a manifesto in 1918. And I'll quote from that. To make a Dadaist poem, take a newspaper, take a pair of scissors, choose an article as long as you are planning to make your poem, cut out the article, then cut out each of the words that make up this article and put them in a bag, shake it gently, then take out the scraps one after the other in the order in which they left the bag. Copy conscientiously. The poem will be like you. And here you are, a writer, infinitely original and endowed with a sensibility that is charming beyond the understanding of the vulgar. Here's one of his. He never went as far as William went as, no, I don't think anybody has really. Here's a couple of Zara's lines, just to give you a taste of 1918 cut-up. During digression, volt right diminishes pressure, render of madmen, topsy-turvy flesh on a monstrous crushing scene, celebrate, but there 160 adepts in not to the put in my mother of pearl, sumptuous of land bananas, upheld illumin, joy ask reunited almost, of has the one so much that the invoked visions of the sing this one laughs. I sort of like, in not to the put in my mother of pearl. Like the little, when the little words get jumping. there's a quote from Burroughs here. At a surrealist rally in the 1920s, Tristan Tzara, the man from nowhere, proposed to create a poem on the spot by pulling words out of a hat. A riot ensued and wrecked the theater. André Breton expelled Tristan Tzara from the movement and grounded the cut-ups on the Freudian couch. Well, it took William quite a few years later to rescue the cut-up from the Freudian couch. He says in a, another quote here. This is also from a 1966 interview in the Paris Review. Cut-ups establish new connections between images, and one's range of vision consequently expands. And also, cut-ups make explicit a psychosensory process that is going on all the time anyway. Somebody is reading a newspaper, and his eye follows the column in the proper Aristotelian manner, one idea and sentence at a time. But subliminally, he is reading the columns on either side and is aware of the person sitting next to him. That's a cut-up. This is also Burroughs speaking. I was sitting in a lunchroom in New York having my donuts and coffee. I was thinking that one does feel a little boxed in New York, like living in a series of boxes. I looked out the window and there was a great big Yale truck. That's cut-up, a juxtaposition of what's happening outside and what you're thinking of. I make this a practice when I walk down the street. I'll say, when I got to here, I saw that sign, I was thinking this, and when I return to the house, I'll type these up. Some of this material I use and some I don't. I have literally thousands of pages of notes here, raw, and I keep a diary as well. In a sense, it's traveling in time. So, you know, we can all do this. Take any, you know, we've all had experiences. I mean, any you know, right now, you're sitting in this room, Kappa Sigma room, you have, you know, some kind of preconceptions about William Burroughs's writing, your knowledge of Burroughs, somebody far away, the attractive or irritating person next to you, noise from outside, colors, etc. Or as a, you know, more like a scientist, you would, you know, that's just discursive cut-up, you could say, and it's going on all the time. But more systematically, you could literally go after the stuff, go after the information, not simply these discursive mind sort of sensory vocalizations or victimizations. You'd literally use this process to, and I said, use this phrase, Williams, get the work, sort of understand phenomena better or attack it, you know, that way, more like a scientist. so you actually can travel, you know, time travel, set travel. Once in a class William gave, conducted years ago, I think it was the early 70s, it was at the City College in New York. He literally constructed this cut-up beast, a creature that would have the radar of a bat, the ability of a reptile to grow back limbs, the poison of a snake, and the like. So in a way, he's always thinking of, you know, putting these things together. It was a very mad, amazing beast. He also employed then, as he's done since in some classes here at Naropa, this writing experiment we just call the walk. And maybe some of you would want to write this down and try it, in which you literally have the intention of, you know, you take a walk with the intention of writing about it, so that you get your, you know, your sort of heavy retention faculties in gear. You note, mentally note, it's not that you're writing as you move, but you literally go out and then come back to your, you know, writing situation. But you note everything you see, as well as everything you're thinking as you're seeing these things, often obviously triggered by what you see, all those images and associations, so that, you know, for example, you pass a blue-haired old lady who resembles your great-aunt Mildred, and so you think of her where she possibly is, conversation or, you know, some kind of association on that level, or maybe she just looks like some, you know, very a real stereotype kind of thing, or, you know, a child, whatever. You see a sign on the door that says, Jesus saves, or whatever, and that takes you, you know, somewhere else. Another sign where you saw those words, or a bus going to Hoboken, that's possible. I guess you can go to Hoboken by bus, et cetera, that kind of thing. And even if you literally have not been to these places, for example, you could be mailing a letter to a friend in Ecuador, Paris, San Francisco, place you've never been, and yet you kind of image on that friend, even on the information, the letter, what you're trying to communicate. You might never have been to San Francisco, but you've seen San Francisco on television. You've seen it in movies. You've seen it in picture books. You've seen a lot of these places, you know, just through all those possible, you know, visuals. Going to a museum, you know, you might see some display of, you know, particular culture, particular tribal culture, say. There was a Maori show at the Metropolitan Museum, I guess it was last year, last fall in New York City. And some of the tribal elders actually came with the exhibit and had to enact various rituals to sort of empower the place and make the place a proper environment for these sacred objects and so on. They actually created, through their ritual and so on, an environment which was probably closer than, you know, it would have been otherwise with just these dead artifacts. You know, so that kind of experience where you go and you see the Kabuki or Balinese theater or whatever, you really get a sense of that, you know, the sounds and textures. And so making use of all of that stuff, all those images, all those associations, all those resonances and correspondences become rich source material for a possible work. And this is Burroughs's view, and as writers, certainly, you know, my view at this point, and I'm sure a lot of others have maybe even worked in some of these directions. And working this way, you know, there are a lot of surprises. You might find that there are auspicious coincidences that seem to occur, or you know, something will come out, a hidden kind of voice. Burroughs and Geisen uses the title the third mind in terms of working with some of these methods and experiments, that actually there's a third energy or mind coming into existence through this kind of work. Hidden voices. Or another experiment would be to take words not your own, you know, and either intercut those with the walk material. You can play with it in a number of ways. But what you do through the walk is actually you gather all this stuff that you didn't have as you sat necessarily. I mean, you probably had different things going on if you were, say, inside that space or in a closed writing atmosphere where you were sitting down to write. I mean, everybody works a number of ways, and everybody has, you know, varying kinds of rituals. But this is, I think John Ashbery once talked about, he'd have a title. He always has his titles before he writes his poems. He'd have his title, and then he'd take a walk, and then come back to the desk and the typer, and then proceed from there. But somehow the walk generated something else, and maybe, you know, took him outside his head in a way, and took him into the phenomenal world. He wasn't, you know, maybe doing something along the lines of Burroughs' walk, but not explicitly that I know of. So you might want to intercut words not your own. You know, intercut the Bible with Time magazine. Work with a tape recorder. I did some experiments in the late 60s and just with people in my own, you know, coming in and out of my apartment in New York and picking up sounds from the street, sounds from, you know, people in the room, overheard conversations, etc. Sometimes it was hidden, you know, sometimes it was not. And then kind of cull those and pare them down. Then you get these overlays of simultaneity, you know, two people talking at once, these funny word combinations. And I have one poem in a really early book, which is literally called Tape, which kind of came down, you know, from that, and includes phrases recognizably off, you know, like a sports broadcast, that kind of thing. But it's, you know, quite interesting to experiment with. So his own teaching, Burroughs' own teaching, his own work is full of such exploration, which actually goes beyond words as such, beyond mere writing, to making more magical connections and organizing words and images in ways that are truly alchemical. Not that all, you know, poetry isn't alchemical and writing in some ways, but this is more deliberate in a way, which is why I use the idea of this, you know, alchemist or scientist, literally taking these disparate things. Or even a person who works with film is actually working a little differently than a straight, narrative, linear writer. Actually taking a lot of images and scrambling them, mixing them up. Well, I want this here, and this can come back there, et cetera. How many people here have worked with film? Or with tape experiments? Okay. Also, you know, this kind of experimentation, as I said in the beginning, does provides a means of escape from this control, this ugly spirit, this possession. And I wanted to read a little section here. There's a very interesting piece at the end of The Ticket That Exploded. It's called The Invisible Generation, and it feels like a kind of addenda to the novel itself. And it's a long, you know, unpunctuated text on some of these ideas, particularly working with film. What we see is determined to a large extent by what we hear. You can verify this proposition by a simple experiment. Turn off the soundtrack on your television set and substitute an arbitrary soundtrack pre-recorded on your tape recorder, street sounds, music, conversation recordings of other television programs, you will find that the arbitrary soundtrack seems to be appropriate and is in fact determining your interpretation of the film track on screen, people running for a bus in Piccadilly with a soundtrack of machine gun fire. Looks like 1917 Petrograd. You can extend the experiment by using recorded material more or less appropriate to the film track. For example, take a political speech on television, shut off soundtrack, and substitute another speech you have pre-recorded. Hardly tell the difference. Isn't much record soundtrack of One Danger Man from Uncle's spy program? Run it in place of another and see if your friends can't tell the difference. It's all done with tape recorders. Consider this machine and what it can do. It can record and play back, activating a past time set by precise association. A recording can be played back any number of times. You can study and analyze every pause and inflection of a recorded conversation. Why did so-and-so say just that or this? Just here, play back so-and-so's recordings and you will find out what cues so-and-so in. You can edit a recorded conversation retaining material which is incisive, witty, and pertinent. You can edit a recorded conversation retaining remarks which are boring, flat, and silly. A tape recorder can play back fast, slow, or backwards. You can learn to do these things. Record a sentence and speed it up. Now try imitating your accelerated voice. Play a sentence backwards and learn to unsay what you just said. Such exercises bring you a liberation from old association locks, and so on. It's a little bit long. Let me go skip ahead a little. Association locks. What was the party like? Switch on playback. What happened at lunch? Switch on playback. Eyes old, unbluffed, unreadable. There's his line stolen from that book he mentions in the beginning. He hasn't said a direct word in 10 years, and as you hear what the party was like and what happened at lunch, you will begin to see sharp and clear there was a gray veil between you, and what you saw, or more often did not see, that gray veil was the pre-recorded words of a control machine. Once that veil is removed, you will see clearer and sharper than those who are behind the veil. Whatever you do, you will do it better than those behind the veil. This is the invisible generation. It is the efficient generation. Hands work and go see some interesting results when several hundred tape recorders turn up at a political rally or a freedom march. Suppose you record the ugliest, snarling southern lawmen, several hundred tape recorders spitting it back and forth and chewing it around like a cow with the aftosa. You now have a sound that could make any neighborhood unattractive. Several hundred tape recorders echoing the readers could touch a poetry reading with unpredictable magic. And think what 50,000 Beatle fans armed with tape recorders could do to Shea Stadium. Several hundred people recording and playing back in the street is quite a happening right there. Conservative MPs spoke about the growing menace posed by bands or irresponsible youths with tape recorders playing back traffic sounds that confuse motorists, carrying the insults recorded in some low underground club into Mayfair and Piccadilly. This growing menace to public order put 1,000 young recorders with riot recordings into the street that mutter, gets louder and louder. Remember, this is a technical operation, one step at a time. Here is an equipment that can be performed by anyone equipped with two machines connected by extension lead, so he can record directly from one machine to the other. Since the experiment may give rise to a marked erotic reaction, it is more interesting to select as your partner someone with whom you are on intimate terms. So he goes on, we have two subjects, B and B. B records on tape recorder one, J records on tape recorder two. Now we alternate the two voice tracks, et cetera. It's one funny conversation. Listen to the two machines, mix it around. Now on tape recorder three, you can introduce the factor of irrelevant response. A nice idea, irrelevant response. So put just anything on tape recorder three, old joke, old tune, piece of the street television radio, and program tape recorder three into the argument. So tape recorder one says, I waited up for you until 2 o'clock last night. And tape recorder three says, what we want to know is who put the sand in the spinach. The use of irrelevant response will be found effective in breaking obsessional association tracks. All association tracks are obsessional. Get it out of your head and into the machines. Stop arguing, stop complaining, stop talking. Let the machines argue, complain, and talk. A tape recorder is an externalized section of the human nervous system. You can find out more about the nervous system and gain more control over your reactions by using the tape recorder than you could find out sitting 20 years in the lotus posture or wasting your time on the analytic couch. Okay, so I'll leave that there. I would recommend that. There's quite a bit more. Also, the idea, this comes up a little bit in here, the idea of a pre-recorded universe. Burroughs, this is also from the lecture at Naropa that's in this book. The theory of a pre-recorded universe is venerable, and many people have believed in it, especially those on the way up believe in their destiny, as they call it. The Arab conception of fate, mektub, M-E-K-T-O-U-B, it is written. It goes back to the Mayan control calendar, it is written. And what is it written on? No doubt, some material similar to magnetic tape, but infinitely more sophisticated. This attempt to predict by controlling and to control by predicting is very old. It can now be computerized. Such modern controllers as Hurst and Luce set out to be the pre-recorded universe, or as much of it as they could pre-record. Wittgenstein says no system may include itself as data. The only thing not pre-recorded in a pre-recorded universe is the pre-recordings themselves. Or to put it another way, the only thing not predetermined in a predetermined universe is the predeterminer. So of course we are listening to pre-recordings of pre-recordings to infinity. However, by listening to and processing a pre-recording, you nullify its impact as a control instrument. What might have shocked your grandmother into a cataleptic state is dismissed with a weary shrug by teenagers. Think of my WASP grandmother, the wife of a circuit-riding Georgia minister, WCTU, colonial dame, forced to witness a pornographic film. Well, don't blame grandma. In actuality, the change didn't happen all at once, but by a series of gradient steps. In time, as any data is widely disseminated by the media, it loses its shock impact. So then the machine has to feed you the pre-recording above that and on back on an infinite tapeworm to the final pre-recordings or pre-recordings which must exist somewhere in some form. Pre-recordings to the people. If the recordings so far received are in any way derivative from the original pre-recordings, and they must be, come to think about it, then the experiment is worth your time. Okay, now I'd like to play a tape. This is the one I mentioned. This is 1978. This is the text of this lecture given by Burroughs here at Naropa in 76, originally entitled It Belongs to the Cucumbers. And that's cut up. The text of the lecture is actually cut up with phrases from this book, Breakthrough, Voices from the Dead, by Constantine Raudave. And this was what the lecture was about, this notion of turning on tape recorders in empty rooms and picking up these incredible phrases. And basically, there were different languages by people appearing on this blank tape run through a machine at high level, a record level, in an otherwise silent, was an absolutely silent environment. So there was no apparent input. I mean, that's mind-boggling in itself. But so what we get here is Burroughs playing with phrases taken from a, from where?
Out of the air.
And in fact, this lecture goes into that, so I, you know, recommend, if you want to look into this a little further. We do have some copies, and it's in the library. Just to give you a little commentary, there's a phrase, we see Tibet with the binoculars of the people. 1970, about the time that these recordings were made, I wrote a story about a Chinese patrol who finds a Tibetan monastery taken over by the CIA to test a radioactive virus. The phrase, you probably belong to the cucumbers. I don't know how many of you are familiar with a term used to designate the CIA, which is the pickle factory. He works for the pickle factory, means he is a CIA man. I think this designation was mentioned in Time or Newsweek. I had already heard it from CIA acquaintances. Etc. Telephone with restraint, comrade. Watch what you say over the phone. The cucumbers are listening in. Blind death, obey death. Compared to Dutch Schultz's last words, maybe some of you know that text of Burroughs, last words of Dutch Schultz, which has the quality of cut up. It's these, you know, very apparent non sequiturs, you know, dissociative phrases, which are quite amazing. Also, Burroughs mentions dream speech, and he had a student at the City College in New York, a phrase, we can come out when shadows cover the cracks. This is from one of my students at City College of New York who encountered Hemingway in a dream and asked him how he could be there if he was dead, and that was Hemingway's reply. Here are some, we can come out when shadows cover the tracks. So I think that's on this tape as well. Are you in salt? Is another phrase. We've been looking all over the place for human beings. Salt could refer to any basic commodity. In this case, since the voices are discarnate, the reference is probably to human bodies. Your blood, as you know, has the saline content of seawater. Ah, good the sea. Now to say, are you in blood, would blow the vampiric cover. Have you stolen horse with him is a German proverb, meaning can you trust him? And so on. I mean, you don't necessarily need some of the commentary on the phrases, but it's, you know, an added of added interest, I would think. So this is Burroughs playing with a tape recorder. And I think actually, probably my guess is kind of leafing through the text and then working in some of these phrases of Roudavet's.
The future through the binoculars of the people. Bobo has the future, a fine, vigorous pig. LA reinforcements, identity and passport is our middle name. This is operational from the thrones and home, even the cucumbers. Here. This is operational, even in the middle. I am short 22 and stolen horses. In the hope that some of you will carry these experiments further and come up with something new. It is the Great Awakening. Recordings made with no apparent input have turned up unexplained voices on the tape. Are you in salt? Phenomena are done with a tape recorder and microphone. A good crossing ahead in the usual way. No sounds are heard or emitted during the recording, but on replay, faint voices of unknown origin. The language dropped natural key. These voices, and you keep up with tech and rig quiz show up at the Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. In 1959, Brian Geisen said that a lecture is attractions, more fun than future vice, and applied the montage technique, which had been used for 50 years in painting, to words on a page. Might be just what I'm look is permitted, out phrases from newspapers and magazines. Then took a scissors and cut these special birds burn, diminish the Great Awakening at random. These cut-up experiments appeared in 19... Who are you in rig quiz show? Accident in U.S. People are sparked. Stop at random and cut in a phrase. How random is random? We know so much that we don't find death, obey death. Bring a halibut. Who are you without jewelry? Body is evidence of the film. The thoughts on this side knew just where he was cutting in. This is operational even to the cucumbers. Put you in touch with the connection of distances of the wolf, the native country loves. We still don't have an ounce of damage. Anything put out up to now is like pulling a figure out of the air. I'm going right back to the Sheraton Carlton and call the Milwaukee Braves. Miss Hannah Pugh, the slim model, drew from a piggy. This is the ants language, the very quintessence of the British female sex. People aren't crazy, she said. Now that hazard has banished my timidity, I feel that I, too, can live on streams in the area where people are urged to be watched. Are you in salt? I demand our authorities. Horribly. Pulled a married couple off a jetty. Here are the cunning ones. We are here because of you. Here are the non-dead. York, Honolulu, Aris, home, Austin. Yo siento, man, pricks pensamiento. Buena cosa, man. Said, I weigh 56. We defend against brutal attack. We see Tibet through the binoculars of the people. Had a fair trial. He looks inevitable and publishes, my sex was an advantage. He boasted of a long, you I friends, where can stay? I see you free of charge. We are already here. Back, see us. I'm practically here. That's bravo. Captain Barron was arrested today in the murdered Sea of Chicago. With binoculars at the border, you have nevertheless to fetch our clothes. Knight claimed his lover on a long trip from the Orient. He streaked across the sky like a... Are you doing mummies to standard? From a distance, observed a roaring blast and a brilliant flash as the operator was arrested. A petite, blue-eyed blonde streaked across the sky and clashed with glass. Lobo has the future. A fine, vigorous pig. Drafted, coordinated. Sabe shit. U.S. people into film orders. Yet. The reason I'm not buying a new couch is never learn. It smells of the operational death. Our birds burn. So simply good right there. You hit her in this new revised edition of After the Great Awakening. Sure, what are you in Rig Midnight? Deep-eyed, unwelcome visitors permitted. The sheer shining color of police. The guard is manifold, is Sterbe in the closet. I, Sequin, perfected this art along the Tang Dynasty. Hurry to make the flutes. Fate decrees. San Diego up to Maine. Have you stolen horses with him? Last skimpy surplus, sir. Room for one more outside, sir, they said, and plunge 17-8. Are you in salt? It is enough. Reason submitted. Called at a bad time. Valiant crowd drew a short 22 and heavy commitments. The Caribbean swells to a roar. A Negro snaps the advantages. Who was raping? Helpers of the Dean, the natural key. The doctor's on the market. Milwaukee convicted of later and lesser crime. Pudgy and... Who is police? We are the language here. Atmosphere and his feet devoid of reality. Will Hollywood never... Pleased to choose studio postulated to you. Royal Knights, teenage, future time. Mine is here in the uncertainty. Can you keep up with tech? 1 ounce of the druggist of shit burned down the city. Give reinforcements. We see Tibet through the binoculars of the people. This is operational. Even wolves do not stay here. Swedish, unwelcome visitor to the Warren, Talent was gone, the temple reeked of time, principle, and agents in force. Here the birds burn, diminish the stopper. Obey death, bring a halibut. You can refuse, it is permitted. A pistol is our man. Here, there are no pure smoke foods. Trunks might burn in continuous operation. Everyone has left Paris. A good crossing. The earth disintegrated. Facts. Professor killed accident in U.S. Don't let me die this way. I'm absolutely weak. I can only just totter home, gnarling. The dollar has collapsed. We can come out when shadows... Good evening, our chap. Our faithful Dietmar. We still don't have the noun. Have done with the seemingly apparent. Hunger divides the world. Remember trains? Turn on. Knowledgeable Goth, the deed of the future. It is almost midnight. We have been looking all over the place for human beings. Are you without jewelry? The lair of the bear is in Chicago. The unconscious imitated. It is difficult in train A. Covering fire, send orders.
Stop there. It goes on a bit. What I was saying before about, you know, a personal feeling about the some of the cut-up work within the novels, actually, not an experiment like this. This was to give you an idea of a more random putting together of, you know, his phrases with someone else's in this, you know, more random way. But the, you know, some of the cut-up work, you know, the idea of it breaking into different mode, atmosphere, more like poetry, and that for me this is the kind of height of his poetry. There, I should mention there that he doesn't, it's not that he's intending to do that. In fact, he has a real almost love-hate relationship to the word. He calls it a killer virus, and doesn't hold the word sacred as such. And yet, of course, he continues to use words to get this very message across. this is from also from that Paris Review interview. People say to me, oh, this is all very good, but you got it by cutting up. I say that has nothing to do with it, how I got it. What is any writing but a cut-up? Somebody had to program the machine. Somebody has to do the cutting up. Remember that I first made selections out of hundreds of possible sentences that I might have used. I chose one. And he goes on, why is the wordless state so desirable? I think it's the evolutionary trend. I think that words are an around-the-world ox cart way of doing things, awkward instruments, and they will be laid aside eventually, probably sooner than we think. This is something that will happen in the space age. Most serious writers refuse to make themselves available to the things that technology is doing. I've never been able to understand this sort of fear. Many of them are afraid of tape recorders, and the idea of using any mechanical means for literary purposes seems to them some sort of a sacrilege. This is one objection to the cut-ups. There's been a lot of that, a sort of superstitious reverence for the word. My God, they say, you can't cut up these words. Why can't I? I find it much easier to get interest in the cut-ups from people who are not writers, doctors, lawyers, engineers, any open-minded, fairly intelligent person, etc. And then further with that, in Nova Express, you indicate that silence is a desirable state. The most